meeting, and I will turn it over to Senator Cohen.
Okay, Madam Chair, members, thank you. As the chair indicated, this is a continuation of our budget reform discussion. We left off with Senator Rest. She is presenting a bill in another committee, and so I'm told she'll be here as soon as she's done. I forgot to mention last time that we also have two other bills as part of this. Senator Sharon has a bill, and Senator John Dahl has a bill. I don't think he's here today, so Senator Rest is going to present his bill for him, and we'll have Senator Sharon here as well. So we're taking this a little bit out of order, but would like to present my efforts. And as I indicated, what I'd like to propose when we're finished with testimony is a delete everything amendment. I have three bills, and Madam Chair, if it's okay, I was thinking maybe I could just present the three bills, and then I think Finance would like to offer testimony, and there are, I think, a couple other people who would like to testify to the committee relative to the collection of bills. If Senator Rest is here, we'll go to her, but tonight I would invite Finance to, I'm not sure if it's Mr. Gustafson and Mr. Schulwalter, to offer testimony as we proceed. Madam Chair, Senate File 3128 has now become an old favorite to the State Senate, and that's the inclusion of inflation in the budget forecast. I think we had some discussion of that when we began. It's obviously an issue that we've heard significant discussion about here in the Senate. It's an issue I've presented to the Senate since 2003, and members will recall that last year I passed my legislation off the Senate floor. It was not taken up by the House, although I think there's a chance they might do that this year. So that's, Madam Chair, there'll be an opportunity to get into discussion about these issues. I thought, again, in the interest of time, I would just go through the bills in front of us. Senate File 3363 is a very simple bill, and we've had some significant discussion about this issue because Senator Rest does some of the same, which is that the Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, and we had discussion about that commission, as members recall, the finance committees of the House and the Senate, in developing our budget recommendations, can require the agencies to provide information that we're looking for. And I think it was Mr. Gustafson who testified about, from their perspective, some of the difficulties, or Mr. Schulwalter, and might have some of the same concerns. The larger bill I have is Senate File 3307. And this is something that I emphasized when Senator Rest was speaking, because some of her bill contains some of the same things I would like to do. And it's been one of my frustrations over the years as a division chairman or the Finance Committee chairman that we don't get as much information as we once did in being able to develop the budget. And so this bill has a data privacy section to allow executive branch budget proposals and details to be made available to the legislature. It also asks for a couple of things in Section 5 and Section 6 that I think important. The first is to have a history that goes 3 years back. And previously, we had more history presented to us. When we look at the budget pages now, we've got the previous year's history, and so that's helpful, obviously. But in the old days, we had a further look back, and this requests information going back 3 years. Obviously, to do a great job with the budget, if we could look back 10 years, 15 years, we'd have that much more information. But certainly, I think if you can go back to, the preceding biennium and plus, and have that full information, it gives us a little bit more of a history. I mentioned Section 6, which requires some of the same provision of information by the agencies to the legislature. But I think most importantly, it provides, as part of the budget pages, that the agency requests be included. And we always had that information previously, where you would look at the governor's recommendation, but you would also have, as part of that, the agency request to the governor. And we can talk about some of privacy needs of the executive branch. I don't think there was ever a problem before in having that information presented to us, because I don't think, you know, you didn't have commissioners who would show up in front of the finance divisions and say, you know, the governor's doing a terrible job. We wouldn't, you know, they wouldn't break away from the administration, obviously, but they would indicate in a perfect world, here's what we would request, here's what we requested to the governor. And I think it is really helpful to be able, members, to have that information where you look at the governor's recommendation and what the agency request was, and you can then ask, okay, if we had more money available, what would you do? Why did you ask for this additional amount of money in making your budget request to the governor? And I always found that, and I'm not sure looking around the table, Senator Berglund, you certainly worked with that kind of information. I'm not sure, Senator Pappas, you might have. I'm not sure when that kind of information left the budget books, but I think it was clearly useful information. At least I found in chairing State Department's originally starting the 93 session, I found that information very, very useful in being able to put together the budget. And I don't see Mr. Watson, who is our historian, who might be able to provide a more explicit history as to when that left the budget books. The other provisions in the bill provide information from the commissioner to find out where we are in terms of cash flow. We ask that if we're going to receive a supplemental budget as a consequence of the forecast, that we receive that within 2 weeks after the forecast. Governor Plenty was very good this year, I think, in getting his supplemental request or getting his budget to us very quickly subsequent to the forecast. And that's helpful to have the information that's that much more quickly, because I think one of the things that happens to all of us is we get supplemental requests from the governor in the regular budget and tax year when we have you know, the even numbered year, such as this year. We get that budget sometime after the forecast, and then we find ourselves as a legislature forced to react fairly quickly. So the opportunity is to provide this information that much more quickly. There's another section that requests the commissioner to notify us of any agency requests in terms of shortfalls. So we, again, have some sense of what's going on. An important section, and I think I'm looking around the table. Somebody raised this at our last meeting with these issues, and that is in Section 11. It states that if there's surplus money, that it's to be transferred to the budget reserve up to 5% of the biennial general fund expenditures. When you listen to the Council of Economic Advisors, they suggest that an appropriate amount for the budget reserve would be 5% of general fund. Now, we're obviously not going to do that this year. We're in a deficit, and we're not likely to do it next year. We'll be in a deficit. But when we have surplus monies, we should try to start making the attempt to build that reserve to a higher amount. We did some of that on the Senate floor last year, and, of course, in putting together the entire budget, we did have some additional money in the budget reserve. But think of where we might be this year. If we had a budget reserve of $1.5, $1.6 billion, and we could justify using this year, we'll say, $500 million of the budget reserve, and we put the rest of the Senate bill together, you know, some cuts, using some of the reserve funds we have, we would find ourselves putting together a budget, I'll suggest, somewhat more easily than has been the case. And you would still have $1.1 billion in the budget reserve left for next year, and arguably a budget reserve that would be able to take care of the entirety of next year's deficit if that number remains the same. Now, I'm suggesting that year to year we use the entirety of a budget reserve, no matter what the deficit might be. But you could well imagine that if we could ever build up that budget reserve to a significant amount, we'd have a much better ability to deal with these downturns in the state budget. So, Madam Chair, that's a brief description of what's in the bills I have. And I'm hoping we're going to find Senator Rest soon.
She's here.
Oh, okay. So, Madam Chair, let me just turn it over for questions or testimony, and then we'll put Senator Rust back on.
Okay. Maybe we'll have Mr. Gustafson and Mr. Showalter come up to the table. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jim Showalter, for the record, State Budget Director at the Department of Finance.
Brent Gustafson, Department of Finance.
Appreciate the opportunity to respond to other parts of this budget process bill. And as Senator Cohen has mentioned, we've discussed many of these points before, and just want to make sure that some of these concerns and observations are available to the full committee. Before we go too far, let me just also make sure that in terms of context, where Minnesota is compared to other states. The handout here mentions some of the other states and how they do some of their process. We've asked our State Budget Association to understand some of the provisions there. And one thing that we've gotten back and we've heard repeatedly is that people tend to do things differently, and that what even some of the terminology, if they say they're doing the same thing, can oftentimes be confusing because there's a lot of complexity in all of these items, and so it's tough to compare across states. One of the ways that we do try to benchmark ourselves is just to understand what Governing Magazine does. When they look at our state, they ask detailed questions about our process. They try to understand how we're trying to manage and what the results of those things are. The most recent Governing Magazine survey was released just a few months ago. And while the overall score wasn't as good as I think most Minnesotans would like, we're still above average, but not a whole lot. Some of the areas that we are particularly strong, some of the few areas that we are viewed as having strength, were in our long-term outlook and in our budget process. Those were two of the five items, where Minnesota was graded as being as strong performers. Mid-level and weaknesses were the other two options. The other thing is just in terms of, you know, presentation of the budget, we're not particularly good at talking about budget process as a public and a branding thing, but it was nice even last year when we did the biennial budget, and the Pioneer Press commented on a number of elements to the budget process and budget recommendations that they didn't like, and the closer was that citizens interested in particular spending can find out exactly what happens. They called it a gold mine for information, and that is that the department tries to get that information out there. What we're discussing here specifically is the budget books. And over time, we've been trying to make sure that we provide more information on the web, more information on an ongoing basis 12 months out of the year. And I hope that's also part of the committee's consideration of how to access information, not just when the legislature starts, because that's a tough thing to do, to understand the entirety when it gets all dropped on you, but instead to understand that part of our department's strategy has been to make sure that information is available all the time, and that, or at least deliver some of those documents early so that you might be able to use those in different ways.
Thank you, Mr. Showalter.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Yes, Mr. Showalter. What going the way you're talking about using the computer or technology fails to deal much with the individuals that are not computer literate, and so a significant portion of the population, in my mind, would be kind of disenfranchised, if you will. What are your thoughts on that?
Mr. Showalter?
Mr. Chair, Senator, a good question. Certainly in terms of budget documents, Minnesota still produces one of the biggest budget documents that are out there. In terms of the level of detail and the amount of volume of information that's included, I don't think you're going to find a lot of states that have more detail that's readily available in their printed documents. That being said, we rarely can anticipate all the questions that somebody is going to raise. So even if somebody has concerns, chances that we are going to specifically address that question in a budget document is modest. Hopefully we anticipate the right questions. Hopefully that information is arrayed in the correct way. But whether they can find it, whether they can understand it, usually they ask fiscal staff. Usually they'll ask the Department of Finance. They'll ask some third party who's more familiar with the budget process. And that's where the web at least will help some people access those custom-made questions more readily. It's not, we're not trying to exclude anybody, but at least open up that information so that more people can become familiar with that information.
Other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, Mr. Showalter, you mentioned the Governing Magazine and they kind of, and you had said that they, for the most part, felt that we did our budgeting process. What were your words in a good fashion?
Madam Chair, Senator, the long-term outlook and the budget process were two of the items that were regarded as a strength for the state of Minnesota. Overall, the survey and the reviews came up in four different categories: money, people, infrastructure, and information.
Okay.
Money had five different items. Three of those were regarded as strengths.
Okay, and Madam Chair and Mr. Showalter, help me with this because there's another magazine put out there by NCSL, and it kind of took our state to task at one time about not having some sort of inflation factor on both sides of the equation.
Mr. Showalter?
Madam Chair, if I may. Madam Chair, Senator Murphy. I think one of the things that has become apparent to us as we've talked with the National Association of State Budget Officers or things like the governing survey that that assess states' processes, I think part of the reason that Minnesota's perceived as having a strength is simply the presence of that out-biennium look at information, that we are consciously weighing the implications of budget decisions today and what that means for not just the current biennium but the next biennium. Any number of areas of the state budget, you may disagree with the processes of how that is anticipated, but the simple fact of the matter is we are looking at the next biennium. I think the other thing to keep in mind is that I think it was Dr. Stinson who commented that in his experience, the inflation discussion has actually had more attention and more focus since it was removed from the statutes at any time when it was present in the actual forecast. And I think it's the balance of what is included for planning purposes. The fact of the matter is we do plan, we do look out, and that's not a universal practice among states. And so while there may be disagreements, I think that's what's perceived as part of that strength characterization by Governing Magazine.
Senator Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chairman, I agree. I think that that is a strength to look out, more than just like next week. When you're making those assumptions about what's going to happen, next year or the year after, in the back of your mind, you're figuring in inflationary rates someplace along the line, and they do show up in most of the documents that we see. What's the problem with doing what the other 49 states do and just, figure it back in? Is there a problem with doing that?
Madam Chair, Senator Murphy, I think there's a wide variety of perspectives of whether that's a problem or not. I think, though it's clear to us, and I think Mr. Mossman would agree, that not all 49 other states have an explicit assumption of inflation going forward, and that we are the sole outlier on that. I think there are, as we think about who we want to compare ourselves to in terms of other states, I think we try to consider our peer group, those who are AAA issuers, those that have AAA credit ratings. Among those states are places like Utah and Virginia. I looked back at some Utah information this morning, and they have, much like us, an explicit do not include inflation type of in their budget development process that agencies are advised to absorb the impacts of inflation. So I think there's just a wide variety of perspectives on that. I don't think we are the only state that somehow has ignored that, and I don't think it's a problem so much as there are different opinions on whether that should be included first or not.
Senator Murphy.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chairman, maybe you can answer me this. In your own personal finances, when you go to kind of look at your budget for the next year, and January, aren't you figuring out what the next fall tuition is going to cost your kids, knowing that you're probably going to have to pay for all of it? Aren't you figuring in what the inflation is going to be on that? And the price of gas ain't going down. And food's not going down. Housing, well, that is going down. But everything else is going up. So how do we, I mean, how when you're putting a budget document together, do you keep an eye in those out years and not, you know, address that issue? I mean, I don't think any of us around the table do it in our personal finances. I don't know why the state. I just, it's always been, it's probably not the biggest sticking issue with me, but it's, you see what I'm saying. I mean, the price of gas isn't going anyplace but up. Steel is going up. The transportation, everything's went up 12 to whatever percent over the past 4 or 5 years. And, you know, if we are going to be one of the states that's on the A list as far as planning, I think it would behoove us to at least figure in some calculation of, even if it was a modest increase in inflation.
Madam Chair, Senator, I think it is a very fair observation to say that inflation is a consideration, something that everyone should take into account. I think whether it's in the forecast or outside the forecast, we've actually done, had a lot of discussion about inflation in the last half dozen years. And it is something that the legislature is probably more aware of than it had been previously, when we would have a forecast that it would give you one set of numbers and then give you a budget with a different set of numbers that didn't include that inflation as a lump sum. Mm-hmm. Whether that's good or bad is obviously up to the committee, but as a person trying to explain the budget, as a person who's trying to help you understand, you know, a $32 billion, $34 billion enterprise, $50 billion enterprise, all funds, it's hard enough with one set of numbers. When we start to have a couple of different sets and forecast time and a different set of budget time, it becomes even more difficult. So it's just one consideration that the committee should think about, too, is that even when we had inflation in the forecast, that wasn't typically the numbers that committee chairs would see. That typically wasn't the numbers that the budget allocations were made off of.
Well, Senators. Madam Chair, the only thing I can say is I hope we don't build bridges using that equation.
Okay. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Showalter, to some extent, is correct that when we had that inflationary increase in the budget forecast, we didn't budget to the dollar with that, but we at least had that as part of what was realistic about the budget. We then could make determinations from that point as to whether or not we would utilize that portion of the budget for inflationary purposes or other purposes. But we always had the information. It was always part of the forecast, and it gave us a much more realistic idea of where the state revenues were. So, again, Mr. Showalter is correct that we didn't budget to the dollar. But that's a little bit different from what now is a total non-recognition of that reality.
Gentlemen, if you can stay with us for a while, I think we'll have Senator Rest present her bills, and then we can talk about all of the bills together, if that's all right. And I see Senator Sharon has arrived, too, so we'll get the rest of the information before us. Oh, Senator Berglund, go ahead.
Madam Chair, thank you. I did have a question for gentlemen that were up there, so maybe now that they're not there anymore, I can just ask it later or something.
Okay.
Well, Madam Chair, actually, I had a question too, but
gentlemen, come back to the table.
we'll
get them both done then.
When someone said, one of them said that Utah or Virginia doesn't use inflation, I wonder if they use it. If they don't use it in both sides of the equation, or if they are like Minnesota and they only use it in one side, like we inflate the revenues in Minnesota in our forecasting, but we do not inflate the spending. So in the state that you referenced, do they take, not only do they expect the agencies to absorb inflation in the spending side, do they not forecast any inflationary impact on the revenue side.
Mr. Gustafson?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, what I looked at in Utah was their instructions to agencies and the development of their budget requests, and it was a request to agencies that they not plan for an increase in resources based on inflation, but rather that they budget for inflationary pressures within existing resources. I don't know enough about their planning and forecasting methodology to know that whether there are discrepancies. I don't think any of us have made any have any illusions about that discrepancy in Minnesota's process, that we know that inflation is implicitly included on the revenue side, but prohibited by law from the expenditure side. I think we all recognize that that is a disconnect.
And I think, so when we look at other states, I think we need to ask that question in their forecasting as they try to have accuracy, accountability, and transparency, not only in their forecasting, but in their budgeting. And that kind of inconsistency, I think, is what drives some of us, and I would expect the Department of Finance as well, just plain crazy in trying to make sure that we're doing we are presenting accuracy in our process. But so I was just curious.
Thank you. And Senator Berglund has a question as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with the way today the fiscal notes are prepared in regard to bonding recommendations. And I'm wondering if normally when there is a bonding project that is either recommended by the governor or just requested by an agency, if there is included in that the operating costs that would be required when the project is finished, if there would be new operating costs.
Mr. Gustafson?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not certain about the fiscal note process as it explicitly relates to that. I can follow up with you. I do know that we have in the past at times had base adjustments for agency operations when it was anticipated that a capital project would result in changes in their operating expenditures. That's no longer the practice. I can't recall whether legislation removed that from practice or if it was an agreement among fiscal staff and agency staff to not include that as a base adjustment. I think we've always believed that it's important to recognize those implications and have that information present when making decisions about capital projects, but we no longer automatically adjust as part of the base any changes up or down as it relates to new capital spending.
Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
I guess the reason I'm asking this question is because this year when the request came to replace and expand the veterans nursing home in Minneapolis, we didn't get any of that information about what the operating costs would be. And I assume, based on the fact that it was an expansion, that there would be additional operating costs over what there were, what there are in the budget today. And I wasn't sure if that was a change from the past, because we don't get that many bonding. I mean, most of ours is like repairs and betterments, da-da-da. I wasn't sure if it was a change in the practice within state government or if it was the transition of the Veterans Homes Board into the Department of Veterans Affairs or why we, because I know we used to get it. And I think we should get it because, by golly, you're not going to build more nursing home beds and not have to pay for the operation of them.
Mr. Gustafson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I certainly agree. I think that type of information should be present when making decisions on capital projects. I can't speak to why that information might not have been available this year. I think we've not made any conscious effort to not have that information present. I don't know the specifics of that issue.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Rustwich, which
Chair,
bills do you
I
have today?
Might, I'm going to be presenting Senator Dahl's bill as well, and if I could start with that.
You'd like
is
to
okay?
start with that one, okay?
Yeah,
we'll get
it's a good looking one.
Not on the agenda.
Oh, okay. Okay, well, I can go back to my other one. That's all right. The language that we're going to be dealing with in the delete all amendment to Senator Cohen's bill is a little bit different than the bill that was as introduced for Senator Dahl. So I'll just come back to it because apparently they're making copies of the change in the language, which I think the committee will like better than what we had before.
Okay.
So I have Senate File 3398.
3398. Okay.
I should have that right.
There it is.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 3398 is another bill in this package of government accountability and reform initiatives that we began a discussion of last week with some suggestions about improvements in the fiscal note disclosure process and also in the way in which budget information was shared and distributed to members of the legislature by the governor and by the state agencies. This is also a bill dealing with, at this point, the Office of Enterprise Technology that would improve the information flow, and in particular about the projects that are suggested in the budgeting process with regard to improvements in technology, and to make sure that all of those requests are vetted through the OET and that we can have a handle on what that process really is. And we're talking about technology, of course. We're not just talking about how many computers somebody's going to buy or an agency's going to buy or just an updating of software, but to make sure that the legislature understands the process by which state agencies and the OET go through in coming up with an analysis that puts a price tag on new technology that is coming into state government and state agencies. And that is what this bill proposes to do, which would then become part of, again, Senator Cohen's bill. When I have met with the commissioner there and his staff and asked about the process, we sometimes don't or I didn't understand that when somebody says, well, this costs between 10 and 20 million. And it's like, well, what do you mean it costs between 10 and 20 million? How come you don't have a price list for what you're going to do and then say it costs 11.349 million? And they explain that it is a dynamic process and that often they frequently talk about the range of costs, and as the process evolves, the numbers become sharper and clearer. And when they are initially presenting a project or when they are hearing from state agencies, they find it impossible just to say it cost $11.39 million. But when they get to a final number, it is fluid because there may be things as they are developing it that they find shortcuts and efficiencies to, and the cost would be less, and/or they find glitches and either in the process or in the application, and the costs end up being more. So that's often why they give us an estimate that has that is a range rather than a specific number, even though in our budget documents we have to have a specific number. So what we're asking for in this bill is for a review by the Office of Enterprise Technology and a reporting function back to the legislature and the committees with jurisdiction over OET, both finance and policy in both bodies, to explain, number one, projects that would cost more than $1 million to make sure that the that project is registered with the OET so that there's a central clearinghouse for technology projects. And then if a project has more a cost of more than $5 million, that the OET has a special oversight function to monitor the progress of that project. If it's more than that, that there would be an annual independent audit of the process, of the progress that's being made by that agency with regard to that that project. And then to ask, and again, as a reporting function and information sharing, that the OET report to the particular legislative committees with jurisdiction the kind of assistance that the OET, so this is an accountability measure back on them, the kind of assistance they provide to each of the state agencies with these projects to in their planning and managing information systems. One might ask, well, why do we have to put this in statute? Well, the same way that we put other kinds of things with regard to the way in which we go about budgeting in the state statutes as well. It's kind of an insurance for tracking information, an insurance for accountability, and also support for the Office of Enterprise Technology in their relationships with other state agencies.
Senator Ress, thank you. I used to serve on Senator Berglund's budget division, and we used to fight about, was it called Health Match? Mm-hmm. The computer system there that was years overdue and zillions of dollars over budget. And I think the plug has finally been pulled on it.
Well, Madam
but
Chair, the
how would your bill affect kind of that, you know, the overruns and all of that? It really doesn't, does it, Senator Berglund?
Well, the interesting thing about Health Match is there was never one dime appropriated by the legislature for the department to do the project. They somehow, and boy, I sure wish I knew how, found the money internally to enter into that contract. And and it would be nice, at least at this stage, since there has been, you know, over $5 million invested in it, to find out what the plan is to take the product or the plan or whatever they're doing to fruition. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know if anybody knows what that plan is.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, this would be an opportunity to have a specified function in OET to review that.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Rest, I think that's a good idea, but at this stage, there's nothing to review. I mean, there's a canceled contract and an attempt by the department not to throw these millions and millions of dollars down the tube because they have brought the project to a certain point. And I guess, you know, it's kind of hard to argue that we should not just throw it down the tubes. But it also would be nice to know what is going to happen, if anything, with the next phase of it.
The other thing, Senator Rust, that used to just, I think I used to have a snit every time it happened, but when we got our fiscal notes, there would be a huge amount of money if you wanted to collect or report any data whatsoever, there would be a line for Health Match.
And it never was less than like $500,000. I mean, you could say, I want this report to include the zip code. And they'd come back and say, well, this will cost $500,000 to somehow go into Health Match. And, you know, because it wouldn't be done for another 6 months, or it wouldn't be done for another 9 months. And so there was always this cost. I think that if the Office of Enterprise Technology can actually get their hands around all these contracts that we have for computer systems and ongoing programming and all of that, and get some sense of it, maybe we wouldn't have to be so frustrated with the costs that come back to us that we have to try to figure out a way to fund. Because I think, you know, that lesson learned with Health Match is, I think, a good one, a good lesson for us all to learn about, you know, as Senator Berglund said, where did the money come from, and where did it go, and where is that product, and do we own the intellectual property rights to that project as far as it's gone, and all those kinds of things that I don't think that the committee with that jurisdiction ever really got much of an answer about. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That really is, I've spent 10 years on Health and Human Services, and it seemed to me that for years there were all kinds of different IT products that they moved on, and that same thing has appeared in other budgets, apparently. Higher ed is one that spent money on various things, but the computers couldn't connect with one another, and so therefore they had a different problem. And I don't know whether that's still a problem area or not, but 10 years ago it was a big problem, and I have the feeling that it probably still is.
Might be right. Senator Cohen? No? Okay. Other comments on...
Well.
Senator Rest,
Chair, I think
excuse me, Senator Berglund.
Maybe if the folks from finance could come up to the table.
I'm sure they could. Go ahead, Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, and whichever of the gentlemen wish to respond, do we know when we will have a progress report on Health Match?
Madam Chair, Senator, I do not know when we will have a progress report on Health Match. Certainly can find that out for you. In terms of the impact of that project and some of the fiscal impacts that the Madam Chair has been mentioning, I don't know that this language would address those, simply because of the nature of that project was so entwined with the health care programs and the significant dollars that go through those programs that that particular project was in a very impactful place for the budget. And it, I think, drove a lot of discussions, perhaps backwards, where technology and the implementation plan for that technology project impacted health policy, which isn't the way I think anybody necessarily wanted to have that discussion. I think what we're talking here is managing and what's the best way to manage IT projects, what is the oversight responsibilities, and I defer to the Office of Enterprise Technology on how to do that. But in terms of the impact or outcomes of the Health Match project, Senator Berglund, we'll have to. I don't have any specifics for you at this moment. I'd be happy to get back with you on that.
Madam Chair, the last hearing we had on this in my division, we were told in 30 days they would have some idea of what they were doing, and of course it's been about 30 days and we haven't exactly gotten a progress report on it, so if you could find out and let me know.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Showalter.
Senator, I would be happy to.
Okay. Madam Chair, there are Rest. Representatives here from OET if anyone wants to hear from them or has any questions about the processes that they use. We have taken into this bill some suggestions of theirs.
Okay. why don't they come to the table? I know I'd be interested in knowing about how some of the big IT projects like CRIMNET, how they would, I mean, they wouldn't actually, the whole project wouldn't move to your department. It would stay in public safety, I assume, but then you would manage it, oversee it? What?
Madam Chair, my name is John Lally. I'm Planning Director for the Office of Enterprise Technology, and I sincerely hope that those projects don't move to our office. Our role in statute is really threefold. The first thing we do is provide tools and templates and guidelines and best practices that agencies should follow in doing projects. And by projects, at any given time in state government, there are somewhere between 300 and 500 IT projects underway. Some of them are very small, $25,000 projects updating a software package. At the other end of the spectrum, you'll have the health matches and CRIMNETs and the maps upgrade and things like that that can run into tens of millions of dollars and a number of years in the execution. So when we've given people guidelines and tools and expectations, it's a way of assisting them and educating them on how to do project management. We also require that projects that are coming to the legislature for funding come through our office and be registered, and we will then review them. And what we're not doing is judging the business value of the project, because that's really up to the agency to decide. What we'll be describing is, does the project look like it's well organized? Does it have milestones? Does it have benchmarks? Does it have deliverables? Is there a governance process? In other words, is the project likely to be successful? But we don't see that information on many projects in state government, including some huge ones, if they don't come to the legislature. Many projects, and I was for a number of years chief information officer for the Department of Human Services, so I know often those projects come with a 90% federal match. So the amount of money that the state has in that system is relatively small compared to the total cost of the system, and the controlling elements of that project are driven by the Federal Department of Health and Human Services, not by state guidelines. They have to, the architecture, the development process, and everything is controlled by the feds, not by the state. And there are other agencies, public safety, education, a number of other agencies that have significant outside sources of funding. And so they typically not had to register a project and go through our review process. Senator Rest's legislation begins to address that by clarifying the fact that we expect to have information on any system that's on operation under development within state government. But the fact is we don't need to see and review all of those projects. The small ones are technical projects. They very rarely have problems. Usually they come into effect, are executed, go into implementation, and there's no problem. We know the reasons that projects fail. They fail for a multitude of reasons, and they generally fail for many reasons at one time, and it's usually having nothing to do with the technology. For example, if the scope is underestimated, if you can't control the scope because it keeps growing and people keep adding to it, which is a very common project with any major system, if it's a multi-jurisdictional system, federal and state and local, if it involves multiple agencies, the risks of failure expand geometrically with the complexity of those systems, and many of these are very complex. Senator Ress addressed, I think, very clearly the issue of not being able to get a hard number for a project at the beginning. It's a little like remodeling a 100-year-old house. You don't know what's going to happen when you open the walls sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so we try to stay on top of those projects, but we have a limited staff to do that, so we try to do it working with the agencies. For example, I don't know all the details of Health Match, but we were consulted a year and a half ago on the Health Match project by the Commissioner of Human Services, and we worked with them. We did a risk assessment, and when they canceled the contract for that because of there were a number of issues, which I think were adequately identified in a legislative audit that was performed, the agency tried to first salvage what they had. Then they took decisive action with our concurrence to cancel that vendor contract and are now embarking on a process, we call it a rescue process, essentially to reestablish good boundaries for the project and bring a new vendor on board and continue. And Senator Berglund, I don't know exactly what the status of that effort is. That's what I assume the Human Services Department will be reporting on. But there are many other systems, the driver's license system that's being advanced by the Department of Public Safety. We've been working very closely with them over the last year, and they've been very cognizant of the need to have good governance process and a good plan and all the elements for major successful systems development. If you look at the private sector and you look at other states, you'll find that on average, about 50% of the projects, major projects I'm talking about, come in over budget or over time or don't exactly deliver what people wanted to do. And that's because user needs change over time, or as they get into the system, they discover there are other functions that they want to add. Sometimes they make mistakes. You usually don't see the private sector ones, but the public sector ones are highly visible because they usually involve cost overruns. What this legislation will help us do is to do the first two parts of our responsibility at gathering information, helping make sure the project gets off on the right foot, and then try to monitor through the reporting process to identify when some of the symptoms of a bad project begin to occur, because oftentimes those are more visible to others than they are to the people within the project. The last function that we do, besides helping them to get it up and then doing the monitoring, is occasionally to intervene. And we try to do that as infrequently as possible. We would rather steer a project down the right path early rather than try to correct it after it's already gone bad, like the Health Match project did.
Mr. Lally, if this bill passes, will your department be asking for more staff to implement this?
Madam Chair, no. Considering the cuts that are on the table right now, we're already concerned about how we're going to maintain what we have. We have a staff of 5 project managers, senior project managers with a lot of experience that we tend to point towards the large projects simply because the complexity is greater and the risks of failure are correspondingly greater. We don't make any attempt to try to manage or monitor every project in state government, which is why the thresholds in Senator Rest's bill are in there, to try to keep it at a manageable level so that we can actually do some good with the people we have in place.
Thank you. Other questions? I have one. Does the department have programmers who actually can do, on staff, can do some of the upgrading that's done or some of the small projects that you talked about?
Madam Chair,
is
yes.
Is this all contracted out?
We have some development staff within the department. They usually work on the systems that we host. OET has 2 different functions, the governance function that's part of the Office of CIO and then what used to be called Intertechnologies Group, which is a service delivery function. And most of our development staff historically has dealt with the systems that we host or support, the networks, the data centers, and things like that. And it's been largely an internal service function since, I think, the mid-'80s. But we are starting to do some small development and facilitate some of that. We are building project management staff that, on a contract basis, could either do work or arrange to have other contract workers come in for the duration of the project and do that work. But that's still a relatively small piece of our business.
Okay. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if you couldn't provide the legislature a list of the various contracts and what the scope is and the dollar cost, if you agree.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, what we do in January of each budget year is present you what we call a portfolio. The portfolio lists the major assets for each agency, the information assets for each agency. We'll cover the mission-critical systems that they have in place, their projects that are currently in major projects, again, that are currently underway, and also their budget requests. And that portfolio comes to you in January. It's thick, and it's data-heavy, and it's obtuse. We're working with staff to try to make it a little more readable this year. But that has a significant amount of information. I believe the contract information you're looking for probably has to come from the Department of Administration, but I'll check into that. We don't do those directly.
Okay. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, do you have a procedure that you recommend for agencies, when they are entering into a technology contract of a large size, in regard to what happens if the company that they have contracted with is acquired by another company?
Mr. Lally?
Madam Chairman, Senator Berglund, we have in state government certain boilerplate that covers some of the usual contingencies for those sorts of things. I think you'd have to go to the individual contract to find what portions of that contract would apply in a situation like that. We try to give them some guidelines, but ultimately our review of the contract is just before implementation.
Senator Berger?
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking you is because you're talking about, you know, templates and best practices, and I would think that that would need to be taken into consideration, because you don't want to enter into a contract with somebody and, you know, give them money to do something and then have the company acquired by somebody else who doesn't intend to fulfill the contract.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I'm not an expert on contract law, but typically my understanding is if a company purchases a contractor, they become the obligees of that contract and must carry it out, or the penalty provisions would go into effect. But you really have to check with somebody who knows the law better than I do in that respect. When we work with agencies, there are many different ways that that project can go. They can go to a turnkey operation, which is basically they contract with vendor for a piece of software and hardware that they bring, put in place, and go with, and it's not customized, all the way to custom development, which involves a lot of design time and a lot of development time, and is like stick building a house as opposed to buying a Wausau home, if that image makes sense. And it really is a matter of what's best for the particular system. The Revenue Department, for example, is buying an integrated tax system that is essentially an off-the-shelf product. It is standardized, it is specialized, but they don't have to do a lot of customization with it. The MAPS replacement project that's being proposed will have some elements of customization to make use of Minnesota law, where we have to have certain things that they do one way here that they don't do in other states. But a lot of it is also going to be commercial off-the-shelf software. Other applications, like our driver and vehicle services system that they're working on, is highly customized, highly developed for Minnesota, because there are a lot of provisions in our state, in our laws, that are not present in most other states, for better or worse. And they have to then do a lot of that development tailored to Minnesota's situation. For each one of those situations, you've got an entirely different contractual relationship with the vendor, from where they deliver the product and drop it by UPS on your door to whether they live with you for 3 years and build it as you go. And I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all solution for that part of it.
Thank you very much. Senator Rest, do you want to talk about your next bill?
Madam Chair, that would be great. And so I would request that you lay over Senate File 3398,
but I don't understand.
And it will return in an amendment.
We will do that. Thank you.
Madam Chair, I do have a handout on behalf of Senator Dahl for the other bill.
Do we need to get this?
And Madam Chair,
Senator,
we were going to have distributed the Delete Everything amendment, because I don't think we have the bill in front of us, and members can find it on page 15, section 24.
Said I wanted to get that passed out as well.
This would be the language from Senator Dahl's bill that would be inserted into Senator Cohen's bill, the bundled bill on government reform and accountability. And it may seem that this particular bill, which was originally 3494, it might seem a little bit strange to be in this bill, because it deals with our whistleblower statutes. But once again, the free flow of information without fear of retaliation or intimidation by state employees to provide that information to the legislature or to any other or to any constitutional officer to if an employee believes that the information they would be providing would indeed improve state services. And in this instance, the budget process is what we are adding to the statutes to protect those so-called whistleblowers, although it seems to me this is not usually what we think of in terms of a whistleblower statute, where people are considered whistleblowers when they are pointing out inadequacies or corruption or some other kind of malfeasance or misfeasance in state government that is being, or in federal government that is being covered up. And right now, of course, we have the scandal at the Federal Aviation Administration with regard to its regulation of the safety measures for airlines, and in particular American Airlines. And we finally are hearing from those whistleblowers. But this is a more positive kind of information that would be protected if an employee wishes to and or does communicate that they would not be retaliated against if they talk to a legislator or a constitutional officer that, in particular about, I bring it up as particularly about budget information, but we have a more general statement here to say it as a way of improving state services, that information can be transmitted and an employee doesn't have to feel that they may be punished for doing so if it's not the official line either of their immediate supervisor or of the state agency or the administration. And the letter that you have from MAEP is to Senator Dahl endorsing the efforts to improve the whistleblower statutes.
Okay. Any questions on this provision? Once again, it's on page 15, section 24 of the delete all that was just handed out. I don't see any. Okay.
I think it's pretty straightforward, Madam Chair.
All right. We'll consider this when we work on the rest of the delete all. Was that all of your provisions, Senator Rest?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. So now do we need to hear from Senator Sharon, Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, that's what I would like to do is allow Senator Sharon to present her proposal, which is Senate File 2767.
She is that in the delete all as well?
Yes. She had a group, except I think we've got that. Has that been distributed?
Yes. The delete all's here.
Well, not the delete all, but I thought we had Senator Sharon's. That's been passed out? Okay.
Okay.
And I'm hoping we'll hear in a minute. I know there's some other people who would like to testify. Mm-hmm. Maybe in the interest of saving time, we could have other testimony if it's possible to interrupt when Senator Sharon arrives. Would that be okay?
We could do that. I believe Ms. Wessel from the Minnesota Budget Project had asked to testify. Welcome.
That's okay.
And we will interrupt you when Senator Sharon comes.
Great. That's a good thing I have it written, and then I'll remember where I was.
There you go.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Christina Wessel. I'm the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Budget Project. We are an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and we provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues with a particular attention to their impact on low and moderate income families here in Minnesota. And while that is our mission, we also understand that it's not just important what decisions are made here at the legislature, but also how those decisions are being made. We believe many of the bills being presented as part of this reform package are important steps in the right direction. These proposals are about ensuring good financial information is available for policymakers and for the public. Over the last couple of years, we have been advocating for a better budget process here in Minnesota, which includes responsible fiscal management, clear lines of accountability, flexibility to respond to short-term challenges and plan for a long-term vision, good financial information, and stability in the decision-making process. And we strongly believe that a good decision-making process depends on well-informed debate, which requires good information and lots of public participation. So, for example, we strongly support Senate File 3128, which would restore inflation. Should we stop now? Perfect time.
Well, I didn't mean like mid-sentence.
No, we'll start a paragraph. So
thank you. We'll bring you back up in a few minutes. Welcome, Senator Sharon.
Yes. Could you orient me a little bit?
We have your bill. Yes, we have your amendment passed out, so people have it.
Okay, great.
This
amendment, I'll describe what the purpose of this amendment is. This is part of some of the discussions that Senator Rest talked about that occurred over the break in which we were looking at government reform. And this bill, this bill, which would now be a part of the Delete All Amendment, does is expand those who can request a local fiscal impact note. I ran, so I'm a little breathless here. Initially, the proposal was to expand it even further, and that was to, in any committee, the chair might be able to request a local fiscal impact note on a bill that had, as a part of it, a possible shifting or probable shifting of costs onto local units of government. But we've, in the course of the meetings and discussions, have reduce that now so that it's not simply the tax chair, but also the chair of the Finance Committee in both houses and House Ways and Means Committee would be able to request a local fiscal impact note to make transparent and more visible to the legislature when we're talking about reducing our state budgets, what it may have in terms of an impact on local units of government. Proposal has been reviewed by the League of Minnesota Cities, by the Association of Counties, and the School Boards Association, that they've participated in the development of the of this proposal. My interest in it is a belief that when we're talking about tax policy, we're talking about how do you appropriately support government services, that we can make a significant change in the public's policy about that without it being a deliberate dialogue. That in fact, when we establish public policy at the state level, that may not have a state budget impact, but has a local budget impact, we are in fact shifting how we pay for government without really talking about whether or not that's the best tax policy. If we're moving away in a subtle way without really being deliberate about it from a progressive tax to something that might be more regressive. So at least through this process, we force ourselves into being engaged further in a more deliberate dialogue about that, understanding what we're doing in terms of the impact on local governments and on property taxes, and being more deliberate about saying what our belief systems are about how government services should be funded.
Thank you. Are there questions for Senator Sharon? Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, one of the problems that currently exists is the fact that we recognize that there is a discrepancy on the impact of local units of government, but we really don't do anything to change that and pretend to just go forward, especially now where we're looking at shortage of money.
Senator Sharon.
I think that's absolutely correct, but I think that that is easier to do for us to do if it's done without visibility, if there's not a transparency to it. It's less likely that the public will become aware and engage in some dialogue with us about the fact that we're doing that, and that has an influence on us. It's likely to change our behavior if it's more transparent and people begin to be participatory in the discussion about what we are doing and how we're impacting the way we fund government.
Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, you perhaps were not here earlier, but Senator Higgins brought forward a thing in regard to the keeping the inmates, if you will, in the jails and prisons, and because we push the short-termers on the county, why they're getting ill-treated. What was it, $9 a day?
The short, if people are to be committed for less than a year in our correction system, they go to the county jails rather than to the prisons. And we until we fixed it in our budget last year, we were paying the counties $9 a day, which was woefully inadequate. So that would be
a
logical one.
Chair Higgins and Senator Berglund can give an example of the sex offenders program that's shifted over to the human services budget, and it's considered a part of health and human service budget, absorbs, gets transferred onto the counties, and then we get concerned that it would eat up all the mental health, if they're going to get a credit for it in terms of their maintenance of effort for mental health services, that it eats up all the mental health services. So I think that there are many places like this that we should be thinking and be more visible and deliberate about the dialogue that and what we are really doing and impacting, especially at the local level for property taxes.
I agree. Senator Berglund.
And Madam Chair, just so everyone in the room remembers, the shift of short-term prison inmates to county government took place during the 2003 legislative session. We just barely began to repair that reduction last session, and we're headed right back there now again. And so the question that one ends up with, is it better to shift a cost onto the local unit of government, like in the case of short-termers, or is it better not to pay for the expenditure at all? I suppose the other alternative would have been just to, you know, reduce everybody's sentence by 6 months so we wouldn't have to pay for it. And those are the terrible dilemmas that we end up in when there is a shortage of resources. And, you know, I'm all for making it all visible. It was visible at the time. We knew exactly what we were doing. Now, I might also add that when somebody is going to be in the correction system for 6 months or less, they barely get them processed before they have to let them go. So it wasn't like this was totally without any rationale to it at all. But there is no doubt about it. It was a shift of financial responsibility onto the counties.
And Senator Berglund, since the counties have that responsibility, they end up going to their taxpayers to make up the cost, rather than us putting that cost on all of the citizens of Minnesota. Tends to be disproportionate to those counties that are taking that share. You're right.
Well, and I mean, we could go through dozens of examples.
Exactly.
Madam Chair. Considering it is the accumulative, it would be interesting to see the accumulative impact that we have in a session on property taxes.
Kind of scary, I think, actually.
People don't want to see it.
Yeah. Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, as much as I'm enjoying this conversation, is it the committee's intention that we adjourn at 2:30?
We'd have to ask Senator Cohen.
Yes.
I know we got a late start, so.
You know, I would assume that's the time we were scheduled, but, you know, it's up to the committee.
Okay. Well, let's move along then.
That's great. Well, Madam Chair, again, apologies to Ms. Wessel. She sat here patiently last hearing, so we can continue her testimony.
Okay. Ms. Wessel, come on back up.
Thank you again, members of the committee. For the record, it's Christina Wessel with the Minnesota Budget Project, and I was just about to start talking about the portions of the bill that we are strongly in support of, one of which is restoring inflation in the state's forecast. These forecasts are really an essential tool for understanding the state's fiscal health. They should be complete, and they should give an accurate picture of how sustainable our budget choices are. Unfortunately, the debate over whether or not to restore inflation often gets muddled by the suggestion that forecasting inflation is the same thing as budgeting for inflation. And we think it's very important to distinguish between providing information about the cost of maintaining the state's current service levels and making budget choices about whether or not to fund inflationary increases. Inflationary pressures are very real. Leaving them out of the state's forecast does not magically make those costs go away. On the other hand, including inflation in the forecast helps us all to understand the long-term costs of sustaining the decisions we are making today, even if we don't always like the answers, but that's what good decision-making is about. Since the legislature passed the law in 2002 prohibiting including the influence of inflation, the Department of Finance has usually found a way to include the information in the forecast anyway, although it still cannot be included in the official numbers. But some have suggested that this comes close enough to solving the problem. However, one of our principles is that there should be stability in the decision-making process. And if it means, and that means if including inflation in the forecast is the right thing to do, then it should be in law. Encoding best practices in law guarantees Minnesota citizens that these procedures will be followed at all times. We shouldn't have to rely on the good sense of whoever happens to be in office. In addition, although the media has done an increasingly good job of picking up on the cost of inflation for the immediate biennium, they have been less diligent in talking about inflationary pressures in the tails. And this is where we need to be focusing more attention to force us to ask ourselves, is the current state of affairs sustainable? Changing the law back so that inflation is once again included in the big numbers that are reported will hopefully help highlight this issue both to legislators and to the public. This is something that's long overdue, and it's unfortunate that this issue, which we believe is just about ensuring we all have good information, has become such a point of conflict. Some of the other provisions in the other bills today we strongly support as well. For example, the provision which would require the budget format to show actual expenditures and receipts for the three most recent fiscal years rather than just one fiscal year. For members of the public, this information can be very challenging to obtain at the program level, but is extremely helpful for analyzing historical trends for people like myself and others. We would also emphasize, therefore, the importance of making this kind of information available to the public, not just to legislators. While you are the ones that ultimately have to make the budget decisions, you should be doing so with plenty of input from the public. And just as the quality of your decisions depend on the quality of the information you have, the quality of our input also depends on the quality of information that we have. So we hope that this information is available to us as well. And we also strongly support the provision to increase the budget reserve equal to 5% of biannual general fund spending instead of capping it at the current 653. And we believe in both the mechanism as well as the level. Automatically refilling the budget reserves by using any surpluses available at the end of the biennium creates stability in the process of rebuilding the reserves after an economic downturn. Putting money into a reserve account isn't very sexy, so using an automatic mechanism offers the best assurance that this responsible step will be taken. It also helps maintain our reputation with the bond agencies. And this mechanism also encourages responsible fiscal management by setting one-time revenues aside in a special place so that policymakers aren't tempted to use it for ongoing funding. It may help to manage expectations of both legislators and the public. You remember back in the November 2006 forecast when we learned we had roughly a $2 billion surplus. After years of deficits and some pretty tough spending cuts, there were lots of hopes for how we might be using these funds. But the reality was only half of that surplus was ongoing and the other half was one time. This change to automatically direct one-time revenue to the budget reserve would give everyone a more realistic picture of the resources actually available to fund ongoing commitments. Once again, it's about shaping what shows up in the headlines. And we also support aiming for a budget reserve level of 5%. It's a lot of money, about $1.8 billion, but it is the level that's been recommended by Minnesota's Council of Economic Advisors. And right now we're learning how important it is to build up a healthy level of reserves. So we hope the Senate will move these proposals forward. They represent some very important steps in improving Minnesota's budgeting process, making it more responsible and ensuring that everyone, both policymakers and the public, have access to the best information on which to make some very tough budget choices. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wessel. Questions? We appreciate it. And thank you again for being flexible. Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, appreciation to Ms. Wessel Mr. Gustafson and Mr. Showalter, and obviously the senators who have presented their parts of this bill. What I'd like to do, and we've had an interesting discussion over these last several hours, I think there's been distributed the A1 Delete Everything Amendment, and what that amendment does is simply incorporate all of the legislation we've listened to into one bill. Okay. There was some discussion earlier about handling this through the individual authors. Ms. Jeffries has done an excellent job in spearheading this Senate effort, discussed with Senator Rest and myself the possibility, particularly given where the House might be, of doing this with one bill. And so I would move the delete everything amendment. Obviously, and if members would allow that to be the vehicle for any further committee debate or amendments, or if people want to save their amendments for the floor, that would be even better. Madam Chair, I believe that amendment has been distributed.
It has. Senator Betzel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, do we need legislative findings?
Senator Cohen, where'd that come from? I saw that and thought immediately of you.
Madam Chair, I move to delete Section 1.
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, I should have known better.
That's right. No, I really didn't say that. On Senator Betzel's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, say no.
No.
Madam Chair?
Yep, Senator Betzel.
Motion prevailed, I take. Okay.
The motion prevails.
Madam Chair, at the bottom of page 9, deficiency requests, one of the things we've been trying to do is make sure that if information is provided to chairs of the any legislative committees, that they also be provided the ranking minority members. This only provides it to the chairs. So I think we may need some language to provide the same information to the ranking minority members. I would.
I'm sure that'd be fine.
Counsel for the proper language.
Okay. Mr. Watson?
Madam Chair, on page 9, line 33, after chair, insert and ranking minority member. Both places where it occurs. I think that's all.
Okay.
Also move, Madam Chair.
All right. Discussion on that amendment? Seeing none. All in favor of Senator Betzel's motion?
Aye.
Aye.
I'm sorry. On Senator Betzold's amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed. The motion prevails. Senator
sure.
Betzold.
On Section 7 on page 4, I mean, we did have a discussion about the appeals process if we disagree with the fiscal note. I'm wondering if we could just revisit that again. I'm not quite sure, you know, if this is actually going to be effective, given the fact that a fiscal note is advisory anyway. What does this really accomplish? And I know this was Senator Rest's bill, Senator Cohen, but do you have any thoughts on that?
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I hesitate to speak in the absence of Senator Rest. I know from my work with her, she felt that having some type of an appellate process would be of help. And Madam Chair, I don't mean to pick out committee members, but Senator Berglund, as an example, has had some significant difficulty with human services because there's such volatility to the budget and to some of the issues involved. We get fiscal notes without an opportunity to contest them. And so I think this language of Senator Rest was an attempt to provide some type of counterbalance. To be honest, again, we had discussions about doing this as a package. I'm not sure if I could. Madam Chair, maybe because Ms. Jeffries was involved with the promulgation of all of this, maybe I could just ask her to respond briefly in Senator Rest's absence.
Okay, Ms. Jeffries.
Hi, Marcy Jeffries, Senate staff. This came out of, again, that work group, and there was a lot of discussion about frustration over fiscal notes. I think you've already heard that. In terms of it being advisory, I think where it's particularly relevant is in human services because on some of those entitlement provisions, the Department of Finance will track the Department of Human Service fiscal note amount, and even if the legislature doesn't agree with it, there's still, in the bottom line, when it's added up, the fiscal note is the amount used. So that's why probably under those circumstances and in the revenue, even though this doesn't apply to revenue estimates, but that's when you would probably be most likely to see this utilized.
Senator
Well,
Betzel.
Madam Chair, I've had my share of killer fiscal notes as well, too, and things that I questioned. And sometimes we ask our fiscal analysts to just go back and double-check the information and talk to the agencies, but I don't know that the system is set up in here is going to actually result in better or more accurate fiscal notes. I mean, there's an appeal process, but you know, I just don't have a sense that this is actually going to accomplish what it's stated to. I mean, yeah, we could try something, but I'm just not convinced that this is the way to go yet.
Ms. Jeffries.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I think the notion was just that a broader discussion, a more open discussion of some of the assumptions would shine more light on how the numbers were arrived at and would give more opportunity for more analysis and deeper probing into where the numbers came from. I don't think people thought it would be utilized very often. I think that in most instances, in fact, discussions between fiscal staff and chairs and authors and departments does improve the fiscal note, but in those rare instances where that didn't work, that this would be a good process.
Ms. Jeffries, would it be possible for Senator Cohen, for example, to challenge the assumptions that the fiscal note was made on, and you know, maybe bring in other information that would make it more relevant? Is that envisioned as part of this whole process?
Madam Chair, I think that's right. That if that was the issue, maybe Mr. Mosman would not want to add something to
Mr. Mosman.
Well, Madam Chair and members, your fiscal staff obviously now can work with you, as Senator Betzold and Ms. Jeffries has commented, with the Department of Finance, the authors, and others, obviously to seek more information on fiscal notes and vet them. And we, in fact, I think, as the Department of Finance has testified, have that opportunity. Time permitting, and depending upon, you know, the timing of when we get fiscal notes, also in the process, the language of what you have before you, what it would allow for is there's actually language, Senator Higgins, relative to what you commented, that is, I think, what has been the discussion is that in situations where there perhaps is not a consensus of opinion about what the fiscal impact of a bill is that can't be otherwise discussed and worked out in some sort of format, that there would be a forum for the executive branch to present its assumptions, the data that they use to compute the fiscal note on, and for those assumptions to be challenged in somewhat of an inquired about in somewhat of an open format, and then to come to some consensus through an alternate process.
Other questions on this part? Okay. Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I've got another question. On page 6, section 12, we talked about this as well, too. Right now, this is where the budget estimates are filed. Currently, agencies have to file budget estimates in the even-numbered year with the commissioner, and it's public information, so to the extent that, you know, the legislature has an interest in it, they have. This would require no later than the first day of October preceding the convening of election, which means an even-numbered year, they file information with the finance committee's legislature. Well, in October preceding the convening of the legislature is always going to be an election year for the House of Representatives. In many years, it is going to be an election for both the House and the Senate. So sending this information to the committees in October, when we don't even know who is going to be, you know, in charge of the legislative bodies, we don't know who's going to be chairing the committees and so forth, seems a little unusual, because, you know, until the elections have been held and the reorganization has been held, you know, maybe the old committee chair has it, but what good does it do to send it to the old committee chair, who may or may not even have that job when the new session starts? So I'm just, again, questioning what are we accomplishing here, sending this information in October of an even-numbered year to people who may not even hold that job any longer?
Senator Cohen.
I'm sure that's an interesting point, and interestingly, this language was suggested by House members on this working group, so maybe reflective of their optimism over the next number of years or not, but it might be appropriate to change that to either November or December.
Well, but Madam Chair, well, the current law does require that by October 15 and November 15, the agency estimates must be filed and made public. And I think that that's a good thing. Regardless of who's up for election or who goes where, I think that those deadlines are currently in law and should be maintained. But, you know, if you want more specific, if you want to break this down and have the more specific information on the list of employees and titles and agency missions and so forth, you know, that probably ought to be delayed. But I don't think we ought to delay the current requirement of filing.
Okay, but and Madam Chair, that's fair enough. I don't know, Senator Betzel, if you want to suggest some changes to this section.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, it takes Senator pretty much Betzel. A rewrite of the section to do it. I'd certainly think we ought to reinstate the current language, and then, you know, if you wanted to start a different section that would, by say, January 15th, you know, then this other information would be provided to the legislature.
Senator Cohen?
I'm sure I'm not opposed to what Senator Betzel is suggesting. I'm not quite sure. I would agree with him that if we're to make some of those changes, it's going to require a significant reworking. I don't know if it would be possible to do that as a floor amendment, either as an author's amendment, Senator Betzel, or an amendment of yours.
Senator Betzel?
Well, you know, again, I'd have to work with counsel. I just don't think this is something that can be done, you know, quickly right here. I think it's going to have to be rewritten.
That's what he said.
Yeah. So I think we should probably have a floor amendment to change this.
Mantra, I would agree with that.
Okay. Senator Cohen, the A3 amendment, that was Senator Charon's bill?
Yes.
That's in the
is it in here somewhere?
Yes, okay. Yes it is. It's,
All right. Is there any other discussion on the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Watson.
Madam Chair, the other day when we were hearing Senator Ress's bill, there was some concern about the public, non-public, private nature of some of the information, and I had done an amendment for her at that time. I don't see her here right now. But
I believe
something to address that.
Ma'am, sure. I don't think she's available. She was leaving for a meeting. I believe. So I don't.
Do you know if Senator Rest is still around?
Madam Chair, Senator Mr. Watson, this is regarding Section 9 on page 5. Yes. Madam Chair, I had some concerns, and we raised that during the discussion as well, too, because I think the discussion was the fact that there's really no. If information is going to be given to the legislature that is right now not public, there's no remedy or anything to do if the legislature decides to take non-public information and make it public.
That's right.
So
maybe Senator Betzold, when you get done reading this, if you'd want to offer
yes.
it.
Yes. Oh, yes. I think okay. This clarifies it. Yes. This,
let's get that
the
passed out.
The A2 amendment, I think, does a better job of addressing that issue we talked about the other day. So on behalf of Senator Rest, I would offer the A2 amendment.
And Madam Chair, I'm told by Ms. Jeffries that Senator Rest is okay with this amendment.
Okay. We'll get it passed out so everybody can see it. Well, that makes a lot of sense. Okay. Make sure that Senator Cohen gets a copy, please. Any discussion on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Any other discussion?
Madam Chair, then, I'm not sure we voted on my delete everything amendment.
We have not yet.
Okay, so I would move the amendment.
As amended.
As amended.
As amended.
All right. Any further discussion on that? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment as amended, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, then I move that Senate File 3363 amended to pass.
Discussion? Seeing none. On Senator Cohen's Senator Cohen's motion, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And I believe we are done. Are we meeting tomorrow, Senator Cohen?
I don't. I don't think so.
We meeting tomorrow?
We meeting